I call this meeting of the Property Tax Division to order pursuant to Rule 10.01. The first order of business is that we need a roll call to determine who is present. The clerk, Mr. Peterson, will now take the roll.
Chair Joachim?
Present.
Vice Chair Gomez?
Present.
Representative Hertas?
Present.
Representative Anderson?
Anderson, present.
Representative Becker-Finn?
Present.
Representative Fisher? Representative Green, excused. Representative Hassan?
Hassan is present.
Representative Marcourt?
Present.
Representative Mortensen?
Present.
Representative Pawlowski? Representative Torkelson? Representative Fisher?
Fisher present.
Go one more time. Representative Pawlowski and Representative Torkelson. All right. There's a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I want to note to all the folks that all the committee documents for today have been sent to members and are on the committee page on the House website. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from January 27th. Representative Gomez, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I have. I'd like to move approval of the minutes as submitted.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Does anyone have any questions on the minutes? And if you do, please raise your hand in the Zoom feature. Seeing no questions, we'll move on to the vote. And this is a voice vote, so members, please briefly unmute yourselves when we vote. All those in favor of approving the January 27 minutes, say aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion is approved and the minutes are adopted. Okay, the first item on the agenda is House File 195 from Representative Detmer. Do I have a motion to move Representative Detmer's bill before the committee?
I so move, Madam Chair. This is Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson moves House File 195 before the committee. Representative Detmer, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just a brief summary. You've probably seen the summary of it from House Research, but I'll just share that with you. And then I also have some other points I'd like to point out too, Madam Chair, if that's okay. House File 195 moves the homestead occupancy application deadlines to December 31st. Under the current law, the property must be occupied by December 1, and the owner must apply by December 15th. In order to qualify for the homestead status in the following taxes payer year, the application deadline for a disabled veteran homestead market value exclusion is also moved to December 31st to match the homestead application deadline. And Madam Chair and members, just some things about the, in Minnesota, disabled veterans may be eligible for the property tax benefit called Disabled Veterans Homestead Valuation Exclusion. That reduces the assessment value of their home property taxes purposes up to $300,000. To receive the benefit, eligible just disabled veterans must own and occupy the homestead home. Due to outdated homestead deadlines and current law, some unfortunate disabled veterans miss out on this important benefit for a year. And in some cases, non-disabled veterans receive the benefit. So what happens is that if they miss that deadline, they were out for one full year, and the person who purchase the property, who might not even be a veteran, will get the benefit. Under the current law, if a disabled veteran purchases a home, likely a newly constructed home, in the month of December, they have missed the December 1 homestead deadline, are not eligible to receive the homestead credit. House File 195 streamlines the deadlines for disabled veterans and homeowners, allowing all homeowners who own, occupy, and apply for homestead benefits within the assessment year to qualify for the property benefits for which they're eligible for. And House File 195 moves the homestead deadline and disabled veterans deadline to the end of the year, which is December 31st, solving this issue. Last year's tax bill moved the disabled veterans exclusion deadline from July 1 to December 15th. This change did not solve the problem that we were working on to address here. And we find that modern technology that counties have now to process the homesteads faster allow for streamlining and more common sense deadlines at the end of the year. And to receive the homestead classification on a new home, a qualified purchaser must apply for the homestead by December 1 to benefit and apply for taxes for the next year. Also, the Minnesota Association of County Officers are neutral on this bill. And I think we have a couple of testifiers too that have said that they would like to testify. And the names that I have, Madam Chair, is Neil Doyle, Director of Veterans Services, the head of the county, and Leah Hurt, or Hart, Assessment Programs Manager for Hennepin County Assessor's Office.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. First, I want to note that Representative Torkelson has joined. Next, Mr. Doyle, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. Representative Detmer did summarize a lot of my talking points. Again, I'm Neil Doyle, the Director of the Hennepin County Veterans Service Office. Aside from the points Representative Detmer summarized, I would like to point out that these are our most disabled veterans that we're talking about in the state of Minnesota, the 70 to 100% disabled veterans. Oftentimes, they do have limited income. In some cases, veterans are under the assumption that their property was homesteaded and they are eligible for the disabled veterans tax exclusion. In some cases, they don't discover this until they receive their annual property tax statements. And then they're kind of shocked to discover that not only they're not eligible for the homestead exemption, they're also not eligible for the disabled veterans tax exemption. And one specific veteran that Hennepin had worked with, a Purple Heart recipient, she was informed this would be an added tax cost that equated to about $430 a month for her. So it is very impactful on our residents. Aside from that, that's about the only other point that Representative Detmer didn't cover that I was planning on talking about. So if there isn't any questions of the committee of me, I'm happy to hand the reins off to the assessor.
Thank you, Mr. Doyle. There may be questions after this. If you can stick around, Ms. Hart, would you like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Leah Hart, and Representative Detmer and Neil did a fantastic job of summarizing everything that really there is to say about this, but I just want to say again that aligning these dates provides more consistent and easily understood processes for everyone, but most importantly, our veterans. Just to mention again, I am the Assessment Programs Manager for Hennepin County, so I manage all of what I like to call our tax benefit programs, including Homestead and the Disabled Veterans Program. And I've been testifying on this change for a couple of years now with the ultimate goal of just trying to bring equity, fairness, and clarity to how our laws line up regarding Homestead, arguably one of the largest property tax programs we have in the state. And all of the different dates are just confusing for everyone and solves multiple problems.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Representative Detmer.
If I could also add that, during the special session in the tax bill, we also passed a piece of legislation that we've been working on for a few years was allowing a one-time transfer of this benefit to surviving spouses. And we finally got that through. And I want to thank Chair Marquardt for including that in the tax bill, because this is something we've been working on for our surviving spouses. And we've done a lot of work with surviving spouses over the last few years by getting rid of that 8-year limit in which they receive that benefit. And I know when I first came into the legislature, it was just a 2-year benefit. We increased it to 5 and then 8 years. And we finally got rid of that 8-year limit. And now we finally also passed during the special session, allowing a one-time transfer of that benefit for a surviving spouse, as long as they transfer, like many might be in a big farm or big house, they would have to transfer that benefit to an equal or less expensive piece of property.
Thank you, Representative Dettmer. I'm going to have, actually, since this is our first bill, one, there's more documents related to House File 195 that have been posted that are in your packets. They include a summary from House Research and a revenue estimate. And since this is our first bill, I'd like Ms. Schill to go over the revenue estimate so that members understand its impact. Ms. Schill.
Good afternoon, Chair Joachim and members. I'm going to move to my screen share in just a moment, and I think I need some assistance to be able to share that screen. Okay, let's see what we got. There we go. Okay, and let's make it a full screen. Okay, so this is a revenue estimate. And for those of you who are familiar with the Tax Committee and Property Tax Division, this is nothing new. But if you are new, you might not be familiar with the structure. So what I've done is divided this particular revenue estimate into 5 different parts, and I'll just do a quick review. Box number 1 is the heading. It includes the date of the estimate, the kind of tax that is impacted, and a brief description of the subject matter. It also has this little box right here, and that gives us a clue of potential administrative costs. And it will cause fiscal staff to take a look at the bill and perhaps request a fiscal note if it is needed. So this might be one of those incidents where you have both the fiscal note and a revenue estimate, but not in this case for Representative Dettmer's bill. You'll see the House file number right here, Representative Dettmer's name, but also the companion bill that is going through the Senate. It's Senate File 25. And then lastly in this little box is the version of the bill. Why is that important? Because we can do revenue estimates on the as introduced version, an author's amendment version, and other versions of the bill. Most commonly at this time of year, there'll be an update, a revised version because of the upcoming February forecast. Okay, box number 2 is the fund impact by fund and by fiscal year. You'll notice that there's no fund listed. That means that these impacts are general fund, but when other funds are impacted, they will be listed separately. We do a revenue note for a 4-year time period. Fiscal 22 and 23 is the upcoming biennium. Fiscals 24 and 25 are the planning years. And then we have the programs impacted. PTR interactions. This is homeowner PTR. I know that because it's homestead related tax deadlines. So these are interactions by the 2 different provisions that Representative Dettmer talked about, which is the homestead provision and then the veterans exclusion portion. I'm seeing in fiscal 23 a negative number. That is a revenue loss or cost savings. A revenue loss is a cost, and a positive number is a revenue gain or cost savings. And then I also see here in fiscal 24 and 25, negligible. Negligible means a revenue impact plus or minus of $5,000. So it will not be scored. Anything $5,000 or less will receive a negligible impact. And lastly, in this box, I see that this is effective beginning with assessments in 2021. We could see a number of different things. It could be assessment year, it could be tax payable year, or it could be a fiscal year, especially if it's an AIDS program. So people like me pay attention to that. Next is the third box here, which is an explanation of the bill. And that basically compares current law with what the provisions in the bill are. So I see two portions that are explained here, and Representative Dettmer already went over that. And box number four is the revenue analysis detail. We'll see things like methodology here. It'll basically give more information on what is going on. And then finally is section number five. Oops, a little bit too far. Section number five is our property tax benchmarks. Since 2011, and yes, it's the 10-year anniversary for this, Department of Revenue has been scoring each property tax bill using the property tax benchmark rating system. Each property tax bill that receives a committee hearing is rated on its impacts to the overall property tax system. There are six principal categories, and the ratings are increase, decrease, or neutral. The rating summary reflects the long-term impacts of a bill on the property tax system, and then they'll also have some occasional notes. So I'm looking at Representative Dutmer's bill, and everything is neutral here. And if the committee would like more explanation on this rating system, I've got, there's a two-page summary available from the Department of Revenue that goes into significant detail. And with that, Chair Joachim, that is the revenue estimate summary.
Thank you so much, Michelle. That's very helpful. Members, we're going to move on to questions. I see Representative Hurtado, you have your hand raised.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Dutmer, for bringing your bill forward. My question is directed perhaps to Ms. Hart or Mr. Doyle from Hennepin County. I was just wondering if you could give us an idea of how many actual veterans or recipients are using this program in Hennepin.
Mr. Doyle and Ms. Hart, who would like to take that?
I can take it. I don't believe I have a definite number, but I want to say it's around 1,500.
Representative Hurtas, did you have a follow-up?
No, I was just curious to see how effective the program is, and that's an interesting number. It's Hennepin, of course, one of the most populous counties. You could probably extrapolate a number from there throughout the rest of the state, but thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hurtas. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to Representative Dutmer for bringing this issue forward. And I'm as much in favor of helping our veterans as anyone is, and I've got a record to show it. But I would draw a member's attention to a letter from Brown County, which I represent from the office there, the assessor's office, with concerns about moving this deadline later. And causing paperwork backups for the county and extra costs for the county, which would, of course, not be reflected in our revenue estimates here at the state level. Perhaps I just want to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly, that this would also affect homestead applications for ag property. Ms. Schill can answer that question.
Ms. Schill, could you answer that for us? Or Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, that's correct. This is the homestead application deadline would apply to ag homesteads and residential homesteads as well.
Representative Torkelson, did you have a follow-up?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just add to that these ag homestead credit applications are quite complicated. They require getting paperwork from the local FSA office, assembling your data for the assessor's office. And, deadlines are important, and deadlines help make sure things get done in a timely fashion. I just imagine how the legislature would work if we didn't have deadlines. We just probably would never get done. So I do have some concerns about this, how it affects the system within especially rural counties. And I'm hoping that we can get more information as we move through the process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. And thank you for pointing out the letter. That was what I was gonna say right before we went back to Representative Dutmer for final comments. Members, are there any other questions for Representative Dutmer? Seeing none, I'd like to thank Representative Detmer for bringing forward the bill. And with that, we'll renew Representative Anderson's motion that House File 195 be laid over for possible inclusion. Oh, I'm so sorry, Representative Detmer, you probably have some final words to say. See, this is what happens when it's the first bill before committee. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. And again, as you know, I have a heart for our veteran community here in Minnesota. And I know, speaking with Troy Olson, with MACO, the Minnesota Association of County Officers, they are neutral on this bill. And but I see the concerns that Representative Torgerson might have for our ag constituents. But I have confidence in this committee, especially you have Representative Marquardt on your committee and different people that are serving on this committee, that you'll be looking into that issue and maybe get some answers. And but keep me informed on the progress that you're doing with this piece of legislation, because this is something we've been working on for a while. So thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. With that, Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 195 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Next up, we have House File 180 from Representative Sundin. Do I have a motion to move Representative Sundin's bill before the committee?
Please.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
This feels like Jeopardy, whoever chimes in first, right? Representative Aisha Gomez moves House File 180 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. So now that we have the bill before us, members, you can find the summary revenue estimate language that was sent to you, and the public can find those documents on the House website. Representative Sundin, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Uikin. And committee. And thank you, Representative Gomez, for moving the bill. House File 180 pertains to an experimental program that we'd like to get moving in Pine and Carlton County. I'll talk about Carlton County just for a little bit. It's got a budget of about $30 million. We've got an elected soil water conservation district. All those members are duly elected public servants. In Carlton County, we've got five watersheds, one native band of original Minnesotans. We have a University of Minnesota Forestry Research Center and a state park, and all the women are strong and all the children are above average. So that said, the House File 180, section by section, the first section, actually authorizes Carlton County and Pine County Soil and Water Conservation District's levy authority. And under subdivision two of that, the tax levy is set at 0.048% of the estimated market value of the district, or $1 million, whichever is less. So there is a cap here. And there's public hearings that are necessary before any of this would come to fruition. So the public has full knowledge of what their elected officials are proposing. Okay, with the hearing notices and all the likely protocol that goes with that. And then there's a budget adoption by the district board, and it's approved by a majority vote of its members. So everything is pretty much out there for public view. There's no secret agendas here. And this authorization for this pilot program actually comes to an end without further authorization in 2024. So with me today is the chair of the Soil and Water Conservation District in Carlton County, Russell Krahiets, and Mr. Krahiets does actually have some of the Soil and Water Conservation District staff with him to answer any questions regarding the bill. If it pleases the chairwoman, I'd like to introduce Mr. Russell Krahiets.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. And first, I have to apologize to Representative Pawlowski. I forgot to note that he had joined us much earlier. So, Mr. Krohayetz, want to introduce yourself for the record and proceed?
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Russ Krohayetz, and I am the chair of the Board of Supervisors at the Carlton County Soil and Water Conservation District. I want to thank you all for taking the time to hear this bill. I also want to thank Representative Sundin for his efforts working alongside us. Minnesota Soil and Water Conservation Districts are special purpose units of government established under state law to carry out conservation programs at the local level. Each SWC has a 5 or 6 member local elected board of supervisors to set policies, provide local input, and ensure oversight and accountability for the district. You should have received a fact sheet about Carlton County SWCD efforts working on alongside Carlton County in our Nemandji watershed, as Representative Sundin mentioned. There are over 857 miles of trout streams and over 278 miles of county and township roads that consist of steep, sensitive clay slopes directly adjacent to these streams. Since 2012, there have been 4 greater than 200-year rain events, including 1 greater than 500-year event across Carlton County. These big rain events have tested and, in many cases, overwhelmed the stream crossings, severing emergency services, disrupting traffic, and eroding thousands of cubic yards of soil and road gravel into sensitive trout streams. We worked together with Carlton County to create a culvert inventory, rethinking culvert solutions, considering aquatic organism passage, and found grant funding to allow a higher price solution that paid long-term dividends regarding maintenance and the ecosystem. This bill and its companion are a culmination of efforts seeking to give these supervisors the ability to work directly with taxpayers who elected them. Discussions started at our supervisor level, then at our county staff and commissioners, as well as with our legislators. Senator Eric and Representative Sundin offered to introduce a bill to pilot levy authority to prove that SWCs would not be negatively impacted if we had the ability to set our own levy. We went before the Carlton County Board, and we received a resolution in your packet, which passed with unanimous support, as did Pine County, who's mentioned as well on this bill. We spoke with the Department of Revenue about the difference in the percentage and the amount on the bills, and they stated that using the estimated market value, EMV, gives a much smaller percentage number. That is what 0.048%, which has been referenced by the DOR, was based on. Using the net tax capacity, as our county auditor did, it gives you a much bigger percentage number because the NTC is a smaller number, as Sundin mentioned. For Carlton, the EMV is $3.2 billion. So a levy resulting in $200,000 would be 0.0063% of the EMV. So that's what's comparable to the 0.048, which is currently in the bill. But the number in our Carlton County Board resolution is based on the NTC. Our county auditor calculated the NTC $33 million, so a levy resulting in $200,000 would be 0.6% of NTC. SWCDs are looked on favorably for being the boots on the ground for conservation efforts. However, as many of you know, making the capacity funding reliable has been a long unresolved issue. Because our work benefits both local and state taxpayers, the projects and the work should have a state and local portion. Last year, the state portion came from the Clean Water Fund. Since we cannot set our own levy, we districts across state rely on county commissioners who are already making tough decisions on their budget. Most districts receive some sort of county allocation, but there are those that receive none. This imbalance results in the state residents paying a greater portion of the conservation efforts in that county. While statutory funding has been verbally supported by many, we chose to take the additional step demonstrating that the locally elected officials of Carlton County, county board, representatives, and senators support us pursuing this pilot. With a fixed duration, as noted in the bill, we expect the outcome of this pilot to prove that our board can be trusted to work with our residents to set and be accountable for our levy. When setting their levy, the county has the ability to reduce theirs by the same amount for the duration of the pilot. The future of this pilot can be giving SWCs the option to pursue obtaining levy authority similarly, knowing that not each SWC across the state was going to choose to do so in the near future. We have a divided nation politically, and Minnesota has a unique bipartisan divided legislature. This gives us national visibility in a time when tension has never been higher. However, this bill is an opportunity for Minnesota to demonstrate being able to rise above partisanship. I have yet to meet a person who does not support SWCDs, a person who does not believe in the voluntary conservation efforts we encourage. It is a core Minnesotan value to care about our water and our natural resources, a reason most of us call Minnesota home, a reason why we voted in 2008 during a recession for the Clean Water and Legacy Amendment. please consider this initiative being a demonstrated step that both parties can support keeping SWC's protecting and enhancing our natural resources. I appreciate you considering this step, that SWCs not only provide value to the community, but being locally elected board, they also should have the ability to set our own levy. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Koharetz. Before we move on, do folks have questions for Representative Sundin or Mr. Koharetz? I see that Representative Torkelson, you have your hand up.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know, are there more presentations before we want to go to comments, or should I comment at this point?
We'll stick to questions right now. There's one more testifier. Any quick questions for Mr. Koharetz or Representative Sundin? I see. So, Representative Torkelson, did you have a question or a comment?
No, I'll wait, Madam Chair, till the testimony is finished.
All right, thank you. Representative Anderson, did you have a comment, a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do have a question. In reading the material last evening, I believe one of the counties, either Carlton or Pine, currently contributed about $200,000 to the SWCD. So a little bit of a question here about your levy authority is going to be up to $1 million. So will, if you levy, I don't know what your intended amount to levy is, but will the county then reduce its levy by that $200,000 that currently they give to the SWCD?
Mr. Koharetz, who represents Sundin, who would like to take that? Mr. Koharetz.
I can start on that. And to be clear, the county currently levies around $150,000. We put, as we were questioned to what number we should put in there for analysis, we placed $200,000 on there, understanding the fact that that would be up to the board when that would be voted upon. So that's an approximation. So I can't guarantee that's the amount, but that is the amount that would be the intent of our Board of Supervisors. So as for what the county would do, I do not have it in writing stating that they would do that, but that is definitely up to the commissioners to take that action. So I can't speak to I cannot guarantee that they would do that.
Thank you, Mr. Koharetz. Representative Sundin, did you have anything to add?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think Mr. Koharetz approached the subject a little more politely than some of us would. Some of the funding in every county is dependent upon the generosity of the county boards, and there is absolutely no consistent measure of funding for any of these soil and water conservation districts. It's kind of a patchwork of how your county board feels about your soil and water conservation district at that particular point in history. So this would is a pilot program, and this would give some consistency for a couple of years and see how this funding mechanism actually will work for the soil and water conservation districts.
Representative Anderson, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up, and just to clarify the issue here. This is for Carlton and Pine counties. Now, they would not be combining. This would be separate authority for each county to maintain its own SWCD, but each county then would have the levy authority for their respective SWCD. Is that correct?
Mr. Koharetz, I see you nodding your head. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson, that is correct. They would not be combining. And if I may just reiterate a point you mentioned, the cap amount that is on there is consistent with language from the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, foreseeing that this bill is something that potentially could be going forward. But as you can see, our district has no intention of setting a levy of $1 million.
Okay. Representative Anderson, any further follow-up? Representative Hurtaz, you have your hand up. Do you have a question or a comment?
I do have a question, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'm not familiar with the topographic relief of the counties that are mentioned here, but my first question would be, how many soil and water conservation districts reside within your county line or your county limits?
Mr. Koharetz?
Thank you, Chairperson and Representative Huertas, within Carlton County, there is one Stone Water Conservation District, and in Pine County, there would be one as well in the both counties.
Representative Huertas, follow up?
Yes, thank you. Well, thank you for that. I don't know necessarily that that would be the circumstances for all counties. There have been issues in the metro here with regard to watershed district, you know, with regard to impaired waters and the responsibility of levying money to deal with total maximum below. This sometimes becomes a challenge with regard to who resides where and where some of these issues happen to be located in. So my concern is that it's generally better to broaden the tax base and to have that taxing authority spread across a larger base. And that is the way it's set up right now with the county. In this circumstance, you're suggesting that some conservation district is the same boundaries as the county. So my question or concern would not apply in this situation, but if this pilot program were to move on to other counties, that may not necessarily be the case. And you may be one of those disproportionate landowners who owns a preponderance of land within a certain watershed or conservation district. And you could find the burden to certain landowners or large property owners to be more significantly on their backs as opposed to spreading that responsibility. So, and just one more follow-up, Madam Chair, my other concern would be that, you know, when you take a line item like this off of the county budget, it frees up their levy capacity to do other things. And so I don't really look forward to the idea of letting the horse out of the barn, so to say, to let every jurisdiction have their own taxing authority. We're kind of in the nation in terms of property taxes as a rank, and but we're not that way with other taxes in this state, and this would contribute to making that more detrimental to owning property in Minnesota if you have these act-on levy authorities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Huertas. I think we're going to go on to the next testifier. Mr. Willett, will you state your name for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pierre Willett with Goff Public, and today I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. I'll be very brief. The Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts does not oppose this bill, but we want all of you to know this is something that we've sought for all SWCD for years without success. We believe that local elected bodies should have the ability to make decisions about raising their own revenue in their own jurisdictions. Remember that SWCDs are independent units of government with over 50 state mandated responsibilities. 24 other entities in the state are authorized to raise their own revenue, and many are not elected bodies. If it is appropriate for Carlton and Pine counties, we should be doing it for all SWCDs. The last thing I'll say that this is not a matter for this committee, but we want to make sure that you all know that just like Carlton and Pine counties, the funds being raised locally are important for the work they do, but they're not designed to replace the state's funding commitment for SWCDs. We view this just like in cities with their LGA and county with a county program aid as a local state funding responsibility. We are, after three bienniums, still trying to find a permanent funding solution for the state portion of that. And we believe this was just not the year to try to solve a general fund expenditure problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Willett. Members, do we have any other questions and then comments for any of the testifiers or Representative Sundin? Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. This is an issue area that I've spent a great deal of time working on over a number of years. I'm very concerned about the state's commitment to SWCDs. We've resorted to the Clean Water Fund a number of times to fund them with some complications. There was an effort to build SWCD funding into the general fund in the tails, but that did not make it through in the next budget cycle a number of years ago. This partnership between the state and counties is critical to the success of SWCDs. If we allow them taxing authority, which I have some serious questions about, I'm afraid that without a state commitment, that the state would just fall back and say, well, the SWCDs can have levy authority. They can levy all they need, and we don't need to have a state partnership any longer with the county organizations. And that, to me, is a huge risk. We also have the complication that watershed districts also operate in a similar fashion. Now, it's unusual in that watershed districts are not elected, the boards are not elected, but they do have taxing authority, which is a bit of a conundrum. But I'm not sure that allowing a taxing authority for SWCDs is going to help us solve that conundrum. I do have legislation that is interested in putting together a pilot program that would look at possibly merging watershed districts and soil and water conservation districts. That's not a conversation for this committee, of course. But I do have some serious reservations about moving ahead with this particular proposal until we've answered some of these other more overarching questions that deal with the state, its commitment to watershed districts. And finally, I just remind everyone that there's nothing stopping the county board from levying for the funds they want to commit to the soil and water conservation district. They can do that and commit those funds, and that's what counties should do. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Sundin, for bringing this very important issue forward for discussion.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson, and thank you for your work around this issue over the years. Members, do I see any other questions for the testifiers or Representative Sundin? Representative Anderson, you still have your hand up?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And second go around, I guess, so I'll be very brief. First of all, I would like to say that we do appreciate much the work that SWCDs do around the states, really the boots on the ground, and they get the work done. And I realize that funding for them is kind of like a never-ending chase where they are never sure of their funding sources, but they do great work. And as Representative Torkelson mentioned, we have this issue of watersheds, and out in my area, it's been kind of a hot button topic that the watershed can levy taxes. And in some instances, they levy some huge amounts for ditch cleanup projects and things such as that. I've heard levies up $100,000 per farm for ditch cleanup. So it really is a sensitive area right now, especially out in my area, at least, of greater Minnesota. So if we went back there and said there's going to be another unit with taxing authority right now, it would, I don't think, play real well in my area. But again, I say that in the sense that to take nothing away from the SWCDs, they do great work. But again, this is a big topic and one that needs a lot of consideration and work as we go on it. So again, thanks to Representative Sundin for bringing it forward. And it's something that we have to work on, and hopefully we can get something done here in the near future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Seeing no further questions, Representative Sundin, final comments.
I'd like to hear from Russell Krahiets again, if he has a couple of comments before I close.
Okay, Mr. Krahiets.
I didn't have too many more closing comments. I appreciate the words and the efforts of all those that are helping move towards a stable funding. And again, we agree wholeheartedly with the end goal of a state and local portion of this capacity funding. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Krahiets. Representative Sundin, have a word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really do appreciate the comments from Representative Torkelson and Representative Anderson on this, and they do recognize the good work. And you know, Representative Torkelson has commented that he's worked on this for a number of years, but there's been no results. And the state organization, as Mr. Willett relayed to us, has been working on this for a number of years, and still there's no no end product here in place. And I think this pilot program actually carries quite a little bit of merit with it, because it's contained to two counties. You know, there's a sunset on it, and certainly, as you can easily see, that there's a true commitment from the board through Chair Russell Kerr-Hyatt. So I'm looking for your support as this bill moves along. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. With that, Representative Gomez renews your motion that House File 180 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. That brings us to our final agenda item for the day, a presentation from the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. We'll have Mr. Peterson go through his presentation and then take questions at the end. This will be kind of an assessing 101, mostly for me. Mr. Peterson, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Peterson. I am currently representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. I am the chair of our organization's legislative committee. I'm also employed as the county assessor of Cass County, located up on the south border of Leech Lake in Walker, Minnesota. I was asked to come here and give a brief Assessor 101, just a basic overview of what the assessor does, why we do it, and how we do it. And like the chair said, that hopefully there's some questions at the end and we can try to answer those also. I have submitted a presentation which Nathan has kindly agreed to help and administer or display on the screen. So hopefully he's able to do that. There we go. Thank you, Nathan. What we do, what assessors do, our job is to value and classify property. Value, what we're looking at, we're trying to determine market value. What is the most typical probable price somebody would pay for a property under typical normal market conditions? Willing buyer, willing seller, arm's length transaction are some of the verbiage that's used when it comes to this. Our job is to try to determine what the market value of a particular piece of property is at a given date during the assessment process. We look at the land attributes, we look at building attributes, and to come up with the market solutions on those. We use mass appraisal process in order to come up with these values. Due to the large volume of properties that we all are allotted to administer, it's impossible to do individual appraisals on each one of these properties, so we have to use the mass appraisal process. And that's a process where we value properties using groups of sales of common data and standardized methods and statistical tests to come up with whether value should increase or decrease in a given area over a given market period. We also classify property. If you want to go to the next slide, Nathan, please. Thank you. We classify based on statute in the different classifications that the legislature sets. And if you look at, I've included the class rate table in taxes payable for 2021, which shows the amount of classifications that we do have in Minnesota. Minnesota is probably the most complex property tax classification system in the nation, as far as I know. Back in 2012, there was a property tax working group study that was presented that included members of the Senate, members of the House, and members of the public, Department of Revenue, assessors, and other associations were involved with that. And I think at that point, I think we had in the ballpark of 55 classifications in different tiers that we have in Minnesota. Right now, if you look at this sheet, we're up to 62. And I think at the time of that study, the nearest state to us was probably South Dakota. They had 14. So Minnesota has a record of adding classifications and adding more complexity to the system as we go, which does make administering the process a bit difficult at times and confusing for the taxpayers also. Next slide, please. How we do it. The statutes are mostly included in through Minnesota statutes 272, 273, and 274. Most of the classifications and tax law, property tax law is included within those statutes. Rules and policies. The Minnesota Department of Revenue sends out directives and oversees the work that the assessors does in order to make sure that we're all doing it uniformly and following statute and being fair and equitable with our assessments. The State Board of Assessors is also another body that oversees the education aspect and the licensing aspect of requirements of assessors to do their duties. Standards, we're using IAAO standards when we use our appraisal practices. IAAA is the International Association of Assessing Officers. We're also using USPAP in our mass appraisal standards, and that's the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practices to follow those guidelines and practices that we use. So next slide, please. Here is a slide showing the annual assessment cycle. Every year, the assessor is required to look at 1/5 of the properties within their taxing jurisdictions, and that's called our quintile. And so we start off typically after the appeal season, we'll start off, we'll pick off 20% of the properties, lay out a program to going forward, and our appraisers will start going out in the field, working the system and visiting these properties, gathering data, making sure the data is accurate, and then entering that data into the system. After the statutory quintile inspections are done, then we move on to our what we call our maintenance process. That's where we're looking at building permits, contacting zoning offices, and going around looking for new improvements. We're also going back and doing checkbacks as far as stuff that was unfinished the prior year. Maybe taxpayers notified us that, hey, something isn't what it seems to be. You need to come out and take a look at it. So we're also going back out and reviewing those properties and taking another look at those. Then once we've collected all the field data, physical data, and implemented that into our systems, then it's time to value and classify. Then what we're looking at is looking at the market. What is the market doing in order to come up with values for the future assessment year? Once we come up with those values and those classifications, and we enter those in our system, then what happens is we send out our value notices. Once those value notices go out, then the appeals process starts. And there are several ways that a taxpayer can appeal their values and classifications. The most typical is an informal appeal, which comes in the means of just calling the assessor's office or contacting the assessor and reviewing the assessments and getting questions, answers, and explanations of why something is the way it is. If you want to go to the next slide, please, Nathan. The annual assessment date is January 2nd of each year. So right now we're working on the 2021 assessment for taxes payable 2022. Our assessment date is as of January 2nd of 2021. And what we're looking at doing, we're valuing and classifying real and personal property. In order to use the mass appraisal process and review those values and come up with new values, we have to do sales studies. We're looking at market activity that have occurred between October 1st of 2019 and September 30th of 2020. And we use those sales to determine the value as of January 2nd of 2021 for the 2021 assessment. Next slide, please. Here's the annual assessment value and classification cycle. Also, the sales study period there once again is October through September. The assessment date is January 2nd, and that will be for taxes payable 2022. The first half of those taxes will be due May 15th, 2022. Next slide, please. Sales study period. The sales ratio is the estimated market value divided by the sale price. So what we're doing is we're looking at the sales that have occurred in a given area in that state study time period that we were giving October through September. And we're comparing the what those sold for in comparison to that previous year's assessment or assessed market value on those properties. And there are several different statistical measurements that we use in order to get equitable assessments. But the main one and the most common one that's probably understandable would be considered the median ratio, the middle ratio. We are given a little window of acceptability within the system. Our median ratio needs to be somewhere between 90 and 105%. That will be on a certain classification within a certain taxing jurisdiction on properties. Typically, we want to be at 100%. But what we do, for example, say if you've got seven sales in a taxing jurisdiction, we'll look at the median ratio. The median ratio is not the average. The median ratio is that middle ratio. So you'll align those sales highest to lowest or lowest to highest. And in this case, if you had seven sales, the median ratio would be that fourth sale in that a grouping of sales. And whatever that ratio is the ratio that will be used by the assessor to determine whether we need to increase or decrease values. And every year, whether these properties are included in our quintile or not, we're looking at the values of all properties throughout our entire taxing jurisdiction. Next slide, please. And when we're doing the mass appraisal process, we're all using different CAMA system, computer-aided mass appraisal systems. There's several consortiums around the state that are being used, they're all a little bit different, but we're all able to input the data and do our statistical measurements and look at the data that's included and get the job done. So we're coming up with values. It's come a long ways. We're able to input and make models and we can make massive value changes, whether decreases or increases, by a push of the button now rather than having to go through the individual pages in a book in each parcel and actually implementing and do the old math and handwritten values in there. So the system's come a long way with technology. Classifying property according to use, that's pretty self-explanatory. We'll determine by going out and looking at these properties or the information at hand on how that property's being used, and we classify it accordingly. Notices of evaluation classification are sent out between January and March. Typically, it's later on in that cycle. They have to go out 10 days prior to the local boards of equalization. Next slide, please. Here's our appeals process. And I mentioned that a little bit before, how most of the appeals are informal appeals. That's where the taxpayer gets those valuation notices and looks at those and maybe says, hey, my value looks too high or something changed, my classification changed. They'll call the assessor's office or contact the assessor somehow and asking for some information. If they don't get the answers they want there or satisfaction and they still feel their assessment's wrong, they have the ability to appeal at our local boards of equalization. Those are our township boards, our city boards. And in those cases, at least one member of those boards and councils have to be certified by the state of Minnesota as having taken some training and know how to operate those boards and what they are allowed to do and not to do. If, for example, a person goes to these local appeal boards and are not satisfied after that, they have the option of going on to the county board of appeal and equalization, which is held in June. There again, if all three of those forms of appeal fail for that taxpayer, they don't feel they get the satisfaction, there's always the option of tax court. So right now, if a person wants to appeal their 2020 assessment on what they're paying taxes on in 2021, they have until April 30th of 2021 to file in tax court. Some of the difficulties and different situations that occurred with the current pandemic situation is we've had to adapt to different ways of holding our meetings. A lot of these local Board of Appeals and Equalizations, they have chosen to do either through Zoom or go to meeting, or we've also done some strictly by phone. But it's amazing, up in parts of rural Minnesota, we had a lot of these local boards choose to continue to hold them in person. So we, for example, Cass County last year, I think we held 20 in-person local boards last year. And typically we hold probably in the mid 30s. So we had over half of ours made the choice to continue to hold them in person. And it's looking like that trend's gonna carry over for this next year. But we've had to accommodate whatever means they wanna use and to be safe and follow the guidelines, the COVID guidelines, in order to keep everyone safe. Next slide, please. Here's our statutory quintile inspections. There again, within every 5 years, we're required to, every year we're required to look at 1/5 of our properties. And that's means a physical inspection of the property, going out to that property, going and looking at it. Once again, with the pandemic, we've had to improvise and change the way we do business. There has been a push in the past that, over the past few years, is to, for Minnesota Association Assessing Officers, for to move our standards closer to the IAAO standards, where they now allow more use of the current technology, the use of more aerial photography, street side photography, that type of technology, where it may allow the assessors, the field inspectors, to be able to do more of it from the desk, rather than to actually going out and looking at the properties. While certainly that does work in areas where the jurisdictions have the financial means to pay for that and to do those annual flybys and drive-bys and to accumulate the technology to do that, most of rural Minnesota cannot afford that. In our zoning, once again, in rural Minnesota is not the same as it is in a lot of the metro areas. There are many areas in rural Minnesota where you do not need a building permit. For example, if you're a farmer and you're putting up a new ag building, you do not need a building permit. So in the absence of actually going out and looking at these properties, you're certainly going to miss properties. The zoning in most rural Minnesota does not require a permit if you're not doing any actual additions or alterations to the exterior of the building, as increasing the size or the height or whatever. If you're just doing maintenance, if finishing the interior, completely remodeling the interior, you're not required to get a zoning permit in a lot of these jurisdictions. So without actually physically going out and looking at these properties, we wouldn't know. So even in the spite of the pandemic and things that are going on, we've still had to, in most cases, continue doing our inspections. We've certainly changed how we do them. We aren't doing as many interior inspections. If we are asked to come in and do something like that, there again, we have to take all the precautions, mask up, glove up, and make sure the taxpayer is safe, our appraisers are safe, and all the COVID requirements are followed. Next slide, please. Valued permitted work and improvements, physical changes. When we're going out after our quintile, when we're starting our maintenance is what we call it, when we're going out and pulling building permits and going out and picking up new homes and remodels and maybe semi-complete stuff from the prior years and additions, there again, in most instances, it requires a field appraiser to go out and look at those properties. And that value is added to our assessment role each year. And that is, that new construction is also labeled and identified And the state does track that also, so we know how much value is equated to actual market conditions and how much value is actually added for new construction. So we do separate that. Next slide, please. Besides doing our annual assessment cycle, mixed into that are all the year-round processes and tax. And in some of your prior testimony on some of the bills, some of those things relate back to this. We are constantly dealing with tax court negotiation litigation. That's just an ongoing thing with the backup of our property tax court system in Minnesota. It could be, you could get a tax court filing and you may not get an active court date until 2 or 3 years down the road. We're still, for example, I think we're 7-8 years out of tax court cases with the Enbridge companies. So that stuff does continue to go on, and it's the assessor's job to monitor and stay informed with that stuff and also negotiate and try to litigate some of this stuff prior to actually getting a court date. We're constantly processing sales and verifying sales. The rules have changed over that or over the years where as the sales come in, we have maybe a special clerical staff in the office that deals strictly with the sales, that processes those, that contacts the buyer, contacts the seller, making sure that each one of those sales is a good sale, an arm's length transaction. There was nothing influencing that sale, whether it be a relative, whether somebody was in a financial strain and had to sell it. And so we're always looking at each of those individual sales and verifying those. Along with that, there are numerous special programs within the property tax system. You were talking about homestead application and moving dates today with House File 195. Homesteads consume a lot of our time, the applications of those, in some instances more than others. Certainly ag homestead by no means is probably the most confusing and convoluted program as far as trying to administer. And you'll see that later on in the slides. I've included the ag homestead flow chart, which we always try to use just to show the complexity of it. But there are several programs that are included. You're talking disabled veterans, plat law, green acres, rural preserve, open space, 2C managed forest is a big one that's out there. And all of these are require applications, and there's dates that these have to be filed and applied by, and the applications have to be in. So the assessor is responsible to administer all of that. Next slide, please. Here is the Ag Homestead flowchart, and it's too small to read, but you can look at that and it makes your head spin. And one thing that we do look at is every year there's usually a bill or two introduced to expand this. We're running out of room on this sheet of paper to actually add more bubbles, but it is very, very confusing. And it's to the point that you almost have to have a person in your office that specializes in this if you have any amount of ag properties within your jurisdiction. So it is, like I say, it's one of those things that it does add a lot of complexity and a lot of time to the assessor's duties. Next slide, please. Okay, the annual calendar of dates and deadlines. These are statutory dates and deadlines that the Department of Revenue sends out to us. Now, once again, it's small, you can't read them, but it just gives you an idea of the different dates that the assessor does have to keep track of. Now, for example, each individual assessor's office will take this set of dates and probably add to it. This starts with 3 pages. I know in my office, we've taken this and revised this. This is now about 5 pages because we have set dates on when we send out the renewal applications for these things. These basically state the deadlines of when people have to apply and due dates, but we have specific timelines within our office on when we send these applications out, renewal applications, and so on and so forth. So it, there again, it does add a lot of extra work to the assessors. Next slide, please. Getting back to the actual time frame of how the final work comes into play. Once we've set our values and classifications, which we're working on right now for the 2021 assessment, we'll start sending those valuation notices. They have to be out 10 days prior to the local boards of equalization. So most of ours will go out, for example, for my county, we'll start sending those out in late February, early March, because we start our boards of review early April. Once those go out, then the appeals process starts. Another statement that's sent out is the proposed tax statement. This is basically our TNT notice, and these go out prior to the budget hearings in December. It's just a notification of to the taxpayer showing them what the proposed tax is prior to the actual levies being set or are using the proposed levies going into their final meeting to set the levies. And in these cases, it'll show last year's current in the proposed tax for the new year. There again, this is another opportunity for a taxpayer to review the information and call the assessor's office if they have questions. It's not an opportunity to appeal, but it is an opportunity for them to review their information. Then there again, in March, tax statements go out. And there again, all the same information is displayed on those and the whole process starts over again. Next slide, please. Some of our resources, you can go on the Minnesota Department of Revenue and go to their site and pop up their tax administrator pages and get they have a tax administration manual, which is very important for assessors to use and refer to. We also refer to IAAO, which we talked about earlier, and our own association is involved with that too. We have resources within our own association that we refer to. Next slide also. I've included a list of the MAO legislative committee members. We currently, the committee is made up of the chair, and we have nine regions. Each of the outstate regions has one representative on the committee. The Metro has four because of the location and the amount of properties and the representation they have down there. They have a larger group on there. So I wanted to include this. So if you ever have any questions, you can certainly get a hold of me anytime. And also within your own areas, you can contact the assessor or the person on the committee from your area and they can relay messages also. Next slide, please. I've also included a copy of our 2021 position statement. MEO on purpose keeps it pretty broad. We don't narrow it down to specific items in most cases. Certainly we have areas that we are working on and concerns, but basically lay it out as we're for uniform and equitable assessments, and we want it to be understandable and transparent to taxpayers. That's the biggie. We've gotten so complex and so confusing with our tax classification system in Minnesota that it's hard to explain it to a taxpayer, let alone administer it in a lot of cases. So we support the consolidation of some of these classes. Right now, like I say, we've got over 62 classifications and tiers, and there's a lot of these classifications that have the same tax rate. So we would support looking at dusting off that 2012 property tax working group study and maybe picking off a little piece of it and maybe combining, say, start with residential and maybe combining a few classes there where there is no tax shift. I think it would be easy to work with groups and other We work closely with AMC and some other organizations that would participate in the Department of Revenue, where we could easily consolidate some of these without actually having a tax shift. We oppose the creation of new programs. Not that we're opposed to what we're trying to do with those programs or who is deserving of those programs, but we're opposed to administering those programs through the property tax system, because we feel there's a better, more equitable way of administering those through a state-administered program, through income tax or tax credits or property tax refunds or different situations like that. A prime example would be the current veterans exclusions. We can all agree, we all support it, it's a great program, but there again, to administer that under the property tax system, it creates unfair equities. You have jurisdictions that have maybe a significant number of these disabled veterans located within their jurisdictions. Carlton County, for example, because of their proximity to a medical facility, they may have an overabundant of population of those where their tax base is, they have a bigger percentage of their tax base excluded than say another neighboring county or a neighboring jurisdiction. So are they disproportionately paying, are their taxpayers getting the burden shift onto to them more than other taxpayers in Minnesota? Yes, probably. So there's probably more uniform ways of collecting those dollars. Next slide, please. I think that might be the end of it.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. That was very helpful. And I wanted to move to member questions, but we have time. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Peterson, for all the information. This has been really informative. I had a couple of questions about like the appeals process, the evaluation appeals that goes to the Board of Equalization. I'm just wondering if you guys collect data on the number of those, like how often are people's appeals granted? How often is evaluation changed? And in the case that a board or even an informal kind of case, like you said, they sort of like email the assessor and say, hey, can my valuation go down? I'm wondering if there is if the board or that assessor articulates a reason for the decrease in the valuation specifically.
Thank you,
Mr.
Madam.
Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Gomez. We do keep track of the number of participants at the local boards of equalization and the county board of equalization. My particular county, we haven't necessarily kept track of the amount of changes we made. It's certainly easy to track. We could go back and we keep records of each one of those meetings, and we have to submit forms to the state of Minnesota after each of those meetings on what got changed, what didn't get changed, how much value got changed. So yes, that data is available and the state should have that within their system. As far as appeals, the informal appeals, typically depending on the timing of those appeals, the assessor is not allowed to make any changes within a certain time frame of those local boards of equalization. So unless it's a clerical error of some sort, we cannot actually make those changes. So those changes would have to go to the board's review in that. And we do keep track of our clerical errors, and those are considered administrative changes where somebody will call us and say, hey, basically the information we had was wrong. So it was a no-brainer to make that adjustment. It was an error on our part. We fixed it. And that did not have to go to the Board of Appeal. That was an administrative change that we presented to the county board, and those changes were made. And yes, those are tracked also.
Representative Gomez, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And then the last part about whether the Board of Equalization articulates a reason for the change in valuation in the case that those are granted.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Gomez. Yes, there again, once Those changes are made. We documented why that change was made. For example, just a simple example would be maybe somebody came to the Board of Equalization and said, hey, my value's too high. You got me down as having a finished basement, for example. That's just a simple generic one. And come to find out, they don't have a finished basement. So the Board of Equalization or the Township Board or the City Council would at that point say, okay, take that value off there. We would make the change. We would document it that the change was made. Change was made due to no basement finish. And the amount of the value change would be listed. And that there again, that information is available.
Representative Gomez, follow up.
Thank you. I'm sorry to be taking up so much time. I just have a couple more little questions. So I'm wondering, because you talked about the kind of mix between the market conditions and then like specific conditions for like an individual property. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, like, you know, as you're kind of looking at that mix, basically I'm like, so I worked at a city for 5 years, and what occurs to me is that there are, you know, I think moving to Zoom probably helps, well, to some extent with accessibility, but like, you know, you have to come down to one of these Board of Equalization meetings in person and sort of have a certain amount of kind of time and energy on your hands to participate in that way. I think, you know, I think about like someone who's working and maybe has kids and, you know, just sort of the time kind of crunch of participating sometimes in even, you know, kind of civic activities that will save you money. And like, if there's if it's discovered that there's something wrong with that market component of the valuation, then does that get changed for all the properties that where that metric was used to evaluate to assess the value?
As far
Mr.
as
Peterson. That makes sense,
oh, excuse me.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Gomez. In the case of a local Board of Equalization, in order for a change to be made, there has to be an appeal. So in the case of a subjective change where something occurred where that board made a change and maybe there is a problem with the neighboring property, typically we are unable to make that change if there was not an appeal. Now, as far as the appeals process goes, certainly they're set up so there's many different ways to appeal, and certainly with the Zoom and everything else that we have available, people can appeal in writing, they can appeal by attending through virtual means, and they can appeal in person, they can have somebody represent them and appeal for them. There are limitations on what a board can do. For example, a local town board, if they wanted to come in and make blanket changes, they are unable to do that. They can make changes to individual properties based on those appeals, and there's also value limitations on what they can change.
Representative Gomez, one more question and then we'll wrap it up.
Yep. Yeah, just one last thing. So what I was trying to get at was, like, if it's found that there's a distortion in, for example, the analysis of like a neighboring property, right? And somebody comes and appeals and it's the Board of Equalization finds, yeah, we messed up this like part of the calculation, that doesn't just apply to that property, but applies to other properties around it that maybe didn't have an opportunity to appeal. There's no process for saying, oh, that piece that we discovered in the course of this appeal applies to this larger kind of geography, so we're going to do a modify the valuation for, you know, other adjacent properties.
The system,
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Gomez. The system really isn't built into it to accomplish those type of situations. That's why the appeals process is set up the way it is. So hopefully that is pointed out or found prior to getting to the point where it is. If there are certain areas or mistakes that were being made, the assessor can go to that town board and say, hey, this is what happened. We would like to make this change, and the town board in those cases can do it. But I've never been involved with a situation like that, so I really don't know. I'm sure it can be done, but like I say, it's typically been a property by property basis. I've never had anybody try to massively change anything. We did have some issues where people tried to massively change classifications, which was denied and wasn't, they weren't allowed to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson, and thank you, Representative Gomez, for the questions. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, I just want to thank folks for your time and attention today. Next week, we'll be meeting on Wednesday, February 10th. We'll hear from the Property Tax Research Division at the Department of Revenue on the most recent BOSS report, as well as a couple of other items. Until then, members, we are adjourned.